Hey Gordo, you know what happened last night?
I saw this morning over breakfast. I was checking my scores very routinely, and the Pens-Caps game did not disappoint, as per usual.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and play a clip and give you just a full sampling of what it was like, all right?
Hit me.
Cole poked a three behind the net. And look out right in front. Burakovsky scores along with Cullen. Centering pass. Look out. They score just like that. His net's off to Williams. Williams swinging wide. Shoots and he scores.
All right, so the Caps here are up 3-0. We're 2 minutes into the second period, and Justin Williams had just scored. And at this point, I was like, oh man, this is such an easy game. The Caps have won 9 in a row. They're killing the Pens. The Pens look dead. And then TJ Oshie got basically elbowed in the face by Patrick Hornquist. And this is what happened literally the next shift after that, all right?
And the Capitals didn't get it out. Malkin with a drive, he scores!
There's one.
Across down to Crosby, in front, Jerry, he scores!
There's two.
And they were just, had their chests out for a long time.
Here's a chance, Foligno scores!
Pens Caps tied.
Daly shoots it, and the save made by Holtby at the post. And now Russ comes out of there with a puck. Try to center, he scores!
There's
now
four.
The Capitals are on the run again in their own zone. Malkin scores another one!
So they scored five consecutive goals to take a 5-3 lead. And then at that point, I was like, oh man, this game is over. The Pens killed them. And so the fun part happened after that. It seemed like every shift afterwards, a player scored. And so I'll play the rest of it here.
Here's a chance now for Shorty shooting. They score. Schmidt closing in. Centers. They score.
All right,
just like that.
We're tied 5-5.
Here's Malkin with it now. Malkin trying to get it to the net. Grubauer. Malkin scores. It's 6-5. Here's Sheary with it. Crosby scores.
7-5.
Sacrificed himself there. There's Ovechkin with a blast. Look at that block by Cole. Rebound goes in.
7-6.
For that tying goal. Kick save made. Rebound. Score.
7-7.
Lars Eller gets his second of the game.
So the Caps tied at 7-7. Miraculously. And so then we went to overtime, setting the scene for Alex Ovechkin bringing the puck up the ice at the blue line. He dekes around Crosby. Crosby sticks his stick and leg out, and he trips Ovechkin. No call. And so we come down the ice, and this is what happens.
Ovechkin is back. Sheary shoots with a save made. And it goes in now. It rolls over the line. The Penguins have won the game.
Heartbreaking.
Yes. So the Penguins won 8-7 in another one of those Caps Pens games where both teams wanted to win so bad, yet for whatever reason, the Caps lost the big game again.
I mean, it was sort of reminiscent to me. Again, I didn't see the game. It aired at about 1 o'clock my time, but I mean, it's sort of reminiscent of that playoff game where Crosby and Ovechkin both got hat tricks a few years back. It's just like the goals just never stopped coming. The excitement never stopped coming. The fans never got to sit down. It's awesome. I mean, it's crazy.
I have never seen any two hockey teams play like this beyond. But they didn't score as many goals. It was Detroit and Colorado back in the day when it was Patrick Waugh. And I don't even remember who the Red Wings goaltender was at the time. I guess
Chris Osgood's got to be.
And there was fights. They hated each other. Every shift, every guy was given 100%. You know what I mean? They were given 100+%. Like, and the games were just so intense. But it's amazing to see the Caps and the Pens because both teams are so optimized. You know what I mean? They're scoring everywhere. And I feel like both systems are really good for each team. And it just exploded into that game. And then the most frustrating part was, and I don't want to be that guy who's like, oh, it's the officiating. It's rarely ever the officiating. But, that Oshie thing, it didn't get called. The Caps kind of got fragile after that. There was a 4-on-4. Penguins score one. Penguins score two in that 4-on-4. Then there was another play where somebody cross-checked Alzner in the back head first into the boards. Another goal happened off of that turnover. Then the Crosby thing happened where he tripped Ovechkin, and then they score in overtime. A lot of people in Washington have been just, oh God, the reaction. I've seen so many tweets. I think I got like 1,000 mentions on a GIF I posted last night, where the Crosby tripped Ovechkin, and then everybody's arguing if it was a trip or not.
I think I saw the clip, and I think that was a trip. I think that, I mean, anytime you're making contact with the leg with your stick, predominantly with your stick, and the guy has the puck, it's not late. It wasn't like after the fact. It was the puck carrier fell down as a direct result of contact with the stick. That's, I mean, that's, I feel like that should be in the Webster's Dictionary as the definition of a trip.
I think a lot of people felt that way. And you know what, to take the other side of that, even though I agree with you, is that it's also a very, very difficult penalty to call in overtime because, you know, if you give a power play to a team, a 4-3 power play is almost a gimme goal in a lot of cases, especially for the Capitals. So I'm sure in some sense the referees don't want to decide the game. But because they swallowed the whistle there, they did in turn kind of decide the game, you know, by not doing anything. So
unless like that trip resulted in a breakaway the other way or something, where like that an instantly game-changing, game-deciding play resulted from the trip, I don't think they can call much in overtime. And it's sort of an understanding, I think. You know, like a puck gets shot over the glass. That's a rule. You've got to call that. But a trip is a decision. And I think if it's not going to lead directly seconds later to the game being decided, then I mean, I think the referees might have done the right thing. Devil's advocate.
Yeah, it felt. I think a lot of fans felt so bitter. I think on both sides because the game was just, it was exciting, but it was also, I don't know. It was like delivering a baby. Like it's just like you were so emotionally spent physically.
It like, always goes back to babies these days, with you, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, that's all I think about. So I have to ask Ashley to do anything now.
Yeah,
like we're in the third trimester. Like you know, I got to be on standby on call. She needs a back rub. I'm there. So. That's my foot rub. All right.
So to sum it up, there, I mean, watching that trip in overtime was a lot like what Ashley's about to go through. Delivering yeah. baby. That was the metaphor you just used for
it's
watching
good,
that Penguins game.
I hope Ashley doesn't listen, or any women that have had children, because then they're going to be mad. But in my manly head right now, that makes sense.
Yeah, very true. It's someone complained once. I think it was Don Cherry, maybe. Actually, probably not Don Cherry. But someone mentioned once, I heard about people refer to sporting events as a war, and how disrespectful that is to people who actually went to war. Like we're playing a game. We're playing hockey. We're not going to war. We shake hands. You know, we're not trying to kill each other.
That's one of many disrespectful things Don Cherry has said.
I shouldn't have mentioned his name. I'm not positive that was him at all. But you know what I mean. Bad sports metaphors. Delivering babies. Going to war.
Now, it's time for the RMNB Podcast.
Okay, so we're finally doing one of these things again. I think it's been a month. The holidays totally screwed us up. And also the infinite games the Caps were playing, where they were playing once every other day, and I never saw my family or friends anymore. But yeah, we're back. The Arm and B podcast is back. Welcome back, Gordo. How are you doing, my man?
I am wonderful. Another wonderful season's greetings to everyone. I know we didn't get to talk leading up to Christmas, so... wishing everyone who's listening a happy holidays, even though it's a little bit belated.
What did you do for the holidays? Because I know that you did something somewhat fancy, I think, for Christmas, right?
Yeah, it was Thanksgiving. I went off to London for Christmas, just before Christmas anyway. One of my best friends from home that I grew up with lives out there, works out there now. So I hopped a flight to London for a couple days. And Ian, I don't know if I talked to you about this before or not, but I went to the World Championship of Darts.
No, you didn't. You said that you were going to tell me about it, so I need to know about it.
It's honestly, it was the most incredible sporting event I've ever been a part of. Without a doubt. Like, to the point where I've never, like, I'm already looking into booking tickets for next year online whenever they are released. The World Series of Darts is the most incredible sporting event I've ever been to. And I went to a Super Bowl once. Keep that in mind. I went to a Super Bowl. I sat probably 12 rows off the field.
And you play hockey. No. You play hockey.
That's true. I've played in the NHL. I've played in the NHL. I've been to a Super Bowl. And the World Championship of Darts is, bar none, the most exciting sporting event I've ever seen in my life.
Okay. So, but why? What about this was amazing?
It was the atmosphere. So you're in a building that seats, it's like a concert hall type thing. It's a building that seats probably 10,000 people, and it is sold out with 10,000 wildly drunken Englishmen chanting and singing in full Halloween costumes. Every single person is dressed head to toe in an outrageous Halloween costume, watching 65-year-old overweight men throw tiny little arrows from 10 feet away from a dartboard. Like, the concept of it was insane. When my buddy told me, hey man, I got tickets to the World Series of Darts, I thought, all right, like, this has to be a joke. Like, I'm only in London for two nights.
This is going
to
be a bad weekend, right?
Yeah, I'm only in London for two nights, and you're bringing me to the World Series of Darts? It smashed expectations. So if anybody's ever in London through, like, the 23rd, 24th of December on through early January, buy a ticket. It is unbelievable. YouTube it right now. Google it right now. Because it's like, just look at the fans. I spent half the time on my phone videotaping the crowd chanting and singing and losing their mind. It was amazing.
Can you text me that somehow? Because I would love to show one of your videos.
Oh, yeah. I can absolutely send you stuff afterwards. But
the people need to see this. Now, like, when here's another question I have for you. The skill level, was it insane? Like, was everybody getting bullseyes and then, like, there was, like, drama if someone didn't? Or, like, was there loud cheering? Like, how insane was this?
There's so much drama. It's like, I can't even describe it to you. Like, these guys are so good. They're hitting, like, the triple 20, triple 20, triple 20, virtually, you know, like, at will. And then it's strategic down the end where, like, you know, they're playing a game called 501 where you start a 501 and every number you hit subtracts off your score till you get down to a reasonable number, and you have to hit a double to finish it off. So if you're down to 12, you got to hit a double six. It's, you know, so there's strategy where they need to place the last 3 to 5 darts to give themselves a good double that they're comfortable with, that they can throw easily. And so when someone misses, it's like the world's collapsing, and the other guy has a chance to swoop in and steal that point, or that leg, I guess they call it. And so the crowd is so into it too. That's the funny thing, is that they're not just drinking and, like, cheersing each other. When their dart is missed, the whole crowd is erupting. There's so much drama for 4 straight hours. It was incredible.
Oh my god! So, does anybody, like, break the dart over their knee? Like, you would maybe break your hockey stick if you miss a gimme goal or something? Like, was there emotion from the players?
Oh, there's disappointment in their faces. I mean, they don't really want to show emotion. I mean, you don't want to let your opponent know you're weak. It's funny, because they interview the guys after every match, kind of thing. And, like, so the one guy was being interviewed while I was sober enough to still understand what was going on in the building. And he was saying, like, oh, you know, I didn't expect my partner there to like, command the pace of play so much. He was really slowing me down, which threw me off. I was like, man, you're throwing darts every, like, 12 seconds. Like, how much different can the pace be? But there's that much. It's like a game of chess. There's so many games within this game. The depth of it was amazing. And it was even more funny to me because the group of guys I was with, we were at a pub beforehand, having a couple chicken wings and having a beer before. And we threw some darts. And so to watch us play darts and then walk into the World Championship of Darts was like watching 6-year-olds play hockey and then watching the All-Star game. It was hilarious by contrast.
Oh, my God. That sounds amazing. Like, I think I'm sold. I mean, I've watched competitive bowling on ESPN before at like 3 a.m. And, I mean, it's like in a shit town in Milwaukee. And, like, if a guy will, like, throw the ball, like, so curved, like, and then it somehow hits every pin and there's a strike and the crowd goes wild and the guy's like 500 pounds and you're like, how does this fat man. How is he so good at this? Like, none of the people look like athletes. It's just so hilarious.
The guy,
the same guards.
Totally. They have intros where, like, they're, you know, they like boxers. They announce the player and they come in and they're like high fiving and kissing babies and stuff on the way in. And so they all have their theme song that have some sort of European reference to their name, where the whole crowd knows their name. And so they're chanting their name during the theme songs, and it's really an electric atmosphere. And they get up there, and it, like I said, it's like watching your grandfather, you know, like walk up to grab his turkey dinner. He just sort of strolling across the stage, this very terribly out of shape individual who's spent his entire life throwing darts in a pub, but is now making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars throwing darts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the winner. Okay, the winner of the tournament. I'm way too into this, by the way. I watch so much darts after I came back.
You're perfectly into this. You're perfectly into this.
I have favorite players now and stuff. I'm trying to look into some playing cards if I can. But so the winner of the tournament, Dutch guy, he this year in 2016, he won like 25 tournaments in a row, or televised tournaments in a row. He's one of the winningest players of the year, blah, blah, blah. He won over 1.8 million British pounds. That's like 2.3, 2.4 million US dollars throwing darts.
Crap.
We're in the wrong line of work, man.
Yeah, really? I should just go to the bar all the time.
Yeah, tell your wife that. I'm training. I'm an elite athlete in training.
This is amazing.
But their walk-up song, their walk-up songs come up. There's like ring girls, like beautiful women in like bikinis, like walk escorting them up there. And like there's a light show, lasers are going around. It's nuts.
I don't even know what to say. That's,
you have to YouTube
so
it.
Hilarious.
You have to YouTube. I'll send you my personal video stuff, but you have to YouTube.
Please.
Everyone should.
Please. I wish I loved something as much as you loved professional dart throwing.
It's the truth. I became overnight, minutes in to walking into that building, I became a fan. I thought, this is amazing. I need more of this in my life. Yeah, so I'm looking at the tickets for next year.
So other than darts throwing, did you do anything? I mean, was the talk of the town Brexit when you're up in London?
No, it was the darts, as they refer to it. Oh, you're going to the darts? Everyone was talking. Every cab driver knew exactly what I was doing, and I told him, hey, I'm going to this dart tournament. He's like, oh my God, you're going to the darts?
Wow.
So there was no Brexit talk. It was the darts was the only show in town.
Not the football, not the Brexit. Everybody is just all about the darts.
And also the costumes. I told you about that. Everyone's in the full Halloween costume. But in England, they call costumes fancy dress.
Give me an example of a few of them.
Costumes? Okay, at the table beside me, there was a guy dressed as a Saudi prince, and all of his friends were like FBI agents with full suits.
I know where this is going.
There were all the Super Mario Brothers. There was just a full section full of ghosts and like terribly dressed, scary, Halloweenish, bloodish people. There was what else did I see? There's Oompa Loompas running around. There was people dressed as dartboards and darts. It was like any Halloween costume you could possibly imagine that you've ever seen was there. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Oh my God!
Fancy dress.
I don't even know. That's amazing. I mean, that's amazing.
I'm thinking of starting my own darts podcast.
I mean, I have nothing that can compare. I mean, I worked on January 1st because the Caps played at night. I didn't even go to a dinner because of that. You know, the Caps had like 3 games in 4 days around Christmas or whatever. So. I have done nothing. And then, you know, my wife's pregnant, so obviously, like I said, all I do is just, I'm around at beck and call to help her. I just love the fact that you can go out there and really experience new things. I mean, Europe and Britain and, there's just so much that we in North America miss out on if we don't go over there.
It's so true. I mean, I've talked about it ad nauseum now, but I'm just so fortunate to take things like that. I have a friend who lives in a big city, and I have it's a 3 hours worth of flights for me. It cost me $200 kind of thing to get into London, England. It cost me more than $200 to get from Halifax to Toronto any day of the week. So, I mean, it's such a luxury here that I'm really, really trying to take advantage of as best I can.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that is just amazing. Now, you also told me beforehand, so what were you doing right before the podcast?
Because yes.
This is very important.
This is very important stuff. Tuesdays are my bachelor days, where we don't get, I know rest of America gets on Monday night, so don't send me any spoilers, people. But for me, Tuesday, we recorded, and me and a couple other guys on the team get together, and we watch The Bachelor on Tuesday, so I was batching tonight.
Very important. Oh, is that what you call it, batching?
Batching, bacheloring. I mean, there's any number of names I could really apply to it that don't make grammatical sense, but that's my best interpretation of the word. I'm trying to batch.
So
I'm batching.
I need your hot takes about, I guess, the episode. I'm guessing that many of our readers actually do watch The Bachelor, and all of you I'm ashamed of and wish you didn't read the site. But I'm sure that Gordo will have a lot of great things that you can relate to. So give me an update. I don't even know who's The Bachelor.
I think this is an extreme guilty pleasure of a lot of people. So I think you're going to be surprised how many people reach out and comment about this whole Bachelor situation. Bachelor's a guy named Nick, who was on a couple seasons of The Bachelorette, where he kept being the runner-up, which I think part of America feels sorry for him, but he's also kind of an enormous douchebag, so America also kind of hates him. So that's why he's obviously on TV again, because they want that sort of media attention. But anyways, I mean, there's still about 25 girls on the show. Plenty of them are sort of going insane moment to moment. The competition is getting heated. There's a couple Danielles that I think are probably the front runners. One girl named Corinne is an absolute nut job. Very entertaining stuff, though. Very entertaining. A lot of oil and water situations going on in this place where nobody really gets along with anybody. It's all fake. It's all wonderful. People watching is the best, and this is the best way to do it.
Now, you told me that this guy slept with two different women or something, and they're both on the show, or did I get that wrong?
I partially got it wrong. I think I'm 99% sure that he came out and has been publicly quoted as referring to, like, spending nights with the bachelorettes that he ended up not being selected to marry. So he sort of outed people of some sexual escapades that I don't think he's really supposed to be talking about. And then actually there was one girl who was on the show and got booted last week who he had, like, a one-night stand with off air, off the show. She ended up being selected by the producers to come and surprise him with some scandalous stuff from his past. Wonderful stuff, I'm telling you. If you get it in one episode, if you can survive the first episode, you're hooked for the season. It gets me every year. Every year I tell myself, like, this is the year I probably stop watching The Bachelor, and I never do.
I say that every Monday for wrestling, and I'm still here.
Very similar, very similar.
I don't even know if guilty pleasure is bad enough to describe my love for wrestling.
Well, both are equally fake. Both shows are equally scripted.
Oh my god! Oh yeah, totally. I don't know. I just love seeing big, manly, idiot men punch each other. I guess that's my affinity for hockey too. So.
Yeah. But, speaking of, are we gonna talk about hockey today or what?
I mean, maybe. I mean, you know, I do have one more question for you.
Hit me.
Is that so? I imagine in Washington or Arlington or wherever Tom Wilson lives, is that he's doing the same exact thing but on Monday nights. So I want you to describe so how many of the players were with you? What was it like? Like, is this the ultimate team bonding experience?
Well, in Sweden here, anyways, there's like a Swedish version of like The Bachelor, Bachelorette. So,
oh, really?
So they're sort of familiar with it, but it's just not the same. But it's not, this one's not even aired really here. We have to sort of slingbox or DVR it or whatever type of technology allows us to watch American TV. We have to do that to get it. So it's just the North American guys that watch it. My neighbor, Garrett Rowe, he's actually a DC resident hockey player. So him and his wife are sort of the ringleaders, I would say. The other American guy, Brock Little, who's on our team, he comes to watch as well. So the four of us really get together and enjoy this touch of American culture that we had at home together. So it's not a huge group, but I mean, it's talked about all week. We're excited about the Tuesday night get together. Who's cooking dinner? Who's bringing the red wine? It gets very girly.
Oh my God, that is so funny. All right. Well, I admire you. Like, again, I don't care what people love as long as they love it with all of themselves. And it's weird. You know what I mean? Like, I admire that passion for The Bachelor.
I have it. You know? I got the fever.
Like, I could have a 2-hour-long conversation about Braun Strowman with my brother. He's a wrestler who just makes loud grunting noises. He doesn't really talk. He just grunts. He's like, like
that's his thing.
Yeah, that's his thing.
I went to in Hershey once. I went to one of these WWE events. I got to meet like some of the wrestlers. Actually, really cool dudes. And the show though took so long. It was like 3 minutes of wrestling and then 15 minutes of talking and then a 15-minute break while they like got ready to do the next bit of talking. So watching it live was absolutely painful. But the guys are really cool. I mean, they were getting in treatment. Beaker was giving them treatment in the room and they were using the gym and stuff. And it was pretty cool.
Wait, do you remember any of the ones you met? Like, you can describe their physiques or face. Like, the Irish guy, I'll be like, oh, it's Sheamus.
I met him.
Oh, God, you met Sheamus. That's awesome.
The Celtic Warrior.
Who is now reincarnated into Liam O'Brien of the Hershey Bears.
good Halifax boy right there.
Yeah, that's right. But do you know Liam by any chance?
I didn't beforehand, but we've skated together in the summers and worked a little bit together in the summers the last couple of years. So just like I say, a handful of times. By the time he's starting to really get geared up on ice, I'm leaving town to go start my season. So we crossed paths in the summer a few times, and we've had some good conversations, but I don't know, we're not best friends or anything, no, not yet.
I may or may not have met him when I had dinner with Connor Carrick and Hershey one night, and he is the coolest guy. Like,
he's just, tuna.
Yeah, the big tuna. I want to know how he got that nickname, but it befits him, because he's like just a great guy, so cool, so nice, you know, and then on top of that, he could just crack your head. In a second.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. He's like one of the, he's just a leader. You know what I mean?
Kyle Mays posted this little clip the other day of him giving the whole, like, what, I didn't do it look after clearly committing an offense and getting a penalty. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did.
Kyle said, like, the shades of Louie or something like that from the Louie Robitaille days. I almost fell off my chair. It was amazing.
Yeah, but hey, Liam got a game. He looked, you know, it's funny, the Capitals have so much depth. I almost feel horrible for a lot of the Bears, even like Jacob Verana. Like, Verana was ready last year, and, you know, he had that week or two stint, and then Barry Trotz made up a reason to send him down, you know, like, or maybe he did something, I don't know, but I didn't notice it. But, you know, they have a lot of guys that just can play, and they have a lot of young guys that are just ready, and That must suck for them in some respects. I mean, they're gonna probably go deep in the playoffs again, and it's a winning atmosphere. But, some of these guys, it's just hard to crack that lineup now.
It's true, but I mean, we talked a little, quite a bit about that, I think, in maybe our opening episode. But I mean, the waiting game is frustrating at times, but it's a long path. I mean, when the kid's 18, Verana, for example, 19 years old, 20 years old. If he plays till he's 33, he's still going to spend 14 years in the NHL, 13 years in the NHL, you know? So I think like 5 years from now, he's going to look back and not even remember how long he was in the American League.
That's a great point. Oh, you know, that reminds me, while we didn't have a podcast, Verana was honored in Hershey by being on a beer glass. I forget who was promoted. I think it was like Pop's Blue Ribbon I think they're Milwaukee. But it was one of the Canadian beer sellers. And he was on there, and it was just funny to me because, like, well, he can't even legally drink in America. Like, yeah. Why don't you pick Garrett Mitchell, who's from Canada and 24 and can drink?
And he's but a Saskatchewan boy. He's probably able to put back a ton of beers.
I would second that.
Something I know about guys from Saskatchewan, they can drink beer.
So I guess that would mean that Brendan Witt could do a kegger then.
But, from what I've heard, yes.
But I thought that was just really funny that they put him on there. And so I wrote a story. I think it was Madeline who wrote a story. And I looked. So after they had the giveaway, I noticed that one of those things popped up on eBay. It went for like $100.
What?
So it was just a glass that was printed in black and white, and the first person who bought the glass on eBay, I saw it because I was following it on eBay because I was just interested, and they went up to $100
for a beer glass.
I'm serious. Like, Gordo, man, if we would have promoted you even more, like, we probably could have been selling some beer glasses at $100 a pop.
I feel like you and I have come up with, like, 100 different ways to get rich since we started this show, and we haven't acted on any of the beer glasses and playing darts. We don't need this game anymore.
It's almost like we hate our lives and wish we were doing something else. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Inventors going wrong.
Yeah, really. I'd be the one guy that would be killed by his invention. Like, there's actually a long list. If you look on Wikipedia, there's like a long list of people that have been killed by their invention, and it's hilarious. I'm actually going to pull the...
Their death is hilarious.
Well, yeah, I mean, killed by their own invention. Wait, you know what? Now I want to read some of these.
Overdose of irony.
All right. I got to find some people that I can say. Okay, Henry Smolinski in 1973 was killed during a test flight of the AVE Mizar, a flying car based on the Ford Pinto and the sole product of the company he founded. That's not funny. I need to find a good funny one.
Flying car killed him.
I mean, it was like someone who went off a cliff.
I heard rumors for years that the guy who invented the Segway died riding a Segway. And then
that's hilarious to me.
But I did research on it, and it was a false rumor. It was all made up. But like something like that would be funny if you like rode your own Segway off a cliff or something. That would. I see the humor in it. But I still think you're kind of dead inside.
Francis Edgar Stanley, 1918. Killed while driving a Stanley Steamer automobile. He drove his car into a wood pile while attempting to avoid farm wagons traveling side by side on the road. Oh, God. Progress is hilarious. I've gone through this thing a few times, and it always brings me up.
I'm telling you, there's something wrong with you.
Here's one. Alexander Bogdanov was a Russian physician, philosopher, science fiction writer, and revolutionary of Belarusian ethnicity who experimented with blood transfusion, attempting to achieve eternal youth or at least partial rejuvenation. He died after he took the blood of a student suffering from malaria.
Oh, do your research, man.
I'm horrible.
Do your homework.
Okay, one more. Carol Susek was a Canadian professional stuntman who developed a shock-absorbent barrel. He died following a demonstration involving the barrel being dropped from the roof of the Houston Astrodome. He was fatally wounded when his barrel hit the rim of the water tank meant to cushion his fall. I'm horrible. All right, sorry. I'm sorry to all the families of people who lost these inventors.
Yes, R.I.P.
I admire their. I don't know what I admire, but it makes me funny sometimes. It makes me laugh sometimes.
Did you ever see that clip? Like it was like the infomercial of that guy who had like this really elaborate ladder that could be like.
No, I did not see those.
I think this is something else everyone on Earth has to YouTube. Like I say, some sort of elaborate ladder where you fold it in certain ways, you can get it like in different positions. And this guy was like, "Look how strong it is!" And he just falls, and like he must like break a couple of vertebrae at least. And it's on tape, and it's like from the probably early or mid '80s, so the video quality is not great, and it's just the worst possible infomercial anyone's ever put together. It's on TV all the time.
You know, it'd be apropos if. RMB technically kills me later. Like, I die of a heart attack because I just don't go outside enough. Dude. Like, that would be apropos. Like,
retinas burn out from looking at the computer for too long or something.
I'm sure someone is listening to me above and going like, oh, I know the perfect way to get this guy back. So, let's see. Oh, I guess we should get to hockey now that we've talked about the dead inventors.
Touch on all the serious topics now. Cavs won 9 in a row. We haven't even touched on that yet.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about that. Yeah, the Cavs won 9 in a row. I don't know how many games you've watched, but for me, I'll say that especially towards the end of the streak, I saw things like instead of Andre Burakovsky trying to contribute by just basically skating the puck into the net and shooting, which is basically all he did. It was like me playing like pro hockey on Nintendo. That was like an old NES game where I just go into the zone and I curl and then shoot a shot from like the center near the point. But he's actually started like forecheck. Like Gordo, you will admire this. Like he, like whenever you know the Caps have a turnover, he's the first guy on the forecheck chasing a guy down behind the net. He forced a few turnovers that way. Like he was just scoring goals by hustling and being in the right place at the right time. And he was already a great player. So you kind of see the building blocks of a great player from him. Then on top of that, it seemed like the team was just playing in straight lines. They were just skating really hard, going in straight lines. No one could stop them. They scored. That's what reminded me of Pittsburgh teams in the past, just using their speed. Chicago teams in the past, just wearing down other teams with their speed. And they have so much skill. If they just play the system and play it really hard, they're hard to beat. So
when you're on a run like that, too, your confidence is such a fickle thing in hockey.
Yeah.
Where when you're making plays and when you're on a 5-7-9 game run like the Caps were on, you just feel like if I don't make this play, I'll probably make the next one. So, I mean, you play with a different level of confidence. And I remember there was a clip from when Columbus was on that enormous streak. The Caps were the ones who broke it, right?
Yeah, they were. They beat them, I think, it was like 7-0 or 6-0.
Yeah, really, really put a beating on them. But near the end of that streak for Columbus, there was like a 3-on-1 or something that was a highlight, and somebody threw like a waist-high saucer pass over a defender that landed on a guy's backhand who one-time backhand passed it to someone else, and the announcer said like, well, that's a play you make when you've won 15 in a row or something like this. And it was very true. It's like, what kind of play was that? Like, what kind of confidence are you playing with where all of you are just making outrageous plays above your skill level? But that's sort of what happens when you get that run going. You feel so good about everything. You walk into the rink feeling like we're going to win tonight. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of how much time they're going to take.
Even last night after the Penguins scored 5 straight goals, you could tell that the Caps were like, no, we still want to win. You know what I mean? They kind of had this like, as soon as they, by the way, so before I even go to that, the fact that, so after the Penguins scored maybe 2 straight goals in a minute, and Trotz didn't call a timeout, and then there was another like a minute later, and he didn't call a timeout, he didn't do anything, and then there was a 4th straight goal, and he didn't do anything. I was really confused as to why Barry didn't either pull Holtby or do something different with his timeouts, but I was so frustrated at home watching that kind of like meltdown in the second period, because a lot of it, and Gordo, you can tell me if I'm wrong. Sometimes guys like start kind of running around a little bit in a sense where they're just kind of like, they're not playing, they're just chasing. And it seemed like as soon as Malkin scored the first goal, the Caps kind of went into that chase mode and they never got out of it. And there was nothing done to like recenter everyone. And I got really frustrated. I was like screaming at my TV. I was like, call timeout. I was like screaming on Twitter too. I was like, call timeout. They need a timeout.
I don't know. I'm not a huge believer in the timeout or like the pulling of the goalie to like change the momentum or something. Or
what is your perspective? Because obviously you've played and you know, like I'm sure for you, it's to inspire you. You know what I mean?
At a timeout, like the most refreshing thing that can happen is if like the worst is when you let up 3, you're getting shelled in the second period or something. You let up 3 and coach calls a timeout, brings everybody in, and just starts losing it. Like, okay, well, that, like, you're just instilling a further sense of panic in an already panicked situation. The best thing that I think can happen is when you bring everyone in and say, look, this is hockey. We're fine. Take a deep breath. Let the crowd get their little rah-rah out of the way, and then let's go back to work. And then, so I think that's sort of the same thing with pulling the goalie. And I always just feel like, damn, Holtze, sorry, man. You coming out, Grubauer going in, wouldn't change the way I feel about this game. I'm still equally attached to it. I just feel really guilty that we hung out to dry. So I don't think that there's like a real change in momentum comes with that. Like I say, unless the coach can just calm everyone's heart rate down by just saying, look, we're fine. We got another period and a half to play. We're down by one. Who cares? But I don't know. I mean, sometimes in a game like that, there's just so much going on. And things happen so fast. And calling that timeout, like you say, after the second or third or fourth, when is the appropriate time? There might not be one. It's like there's just the game is happening too fast. And if Barry didn't think that it was going to be a good time to calm everyone down, then he's making the right decision. This guy's coached God knows how many games in the NHL. He knows what he's doing a hell of a lot better than I do. So I trust him. They almost won in overtime, too. So if they would have won that game 8-7, I don't think he would have been so mad about this whole lack of timeout calling.
I don't know. I probably still would have. I don't know. But I hear you. I will trust what you're saying over my initial fan watching over the last 20 years. You know, I think also, too, there's probably a lot of things that coaches do or don't do that doesn't really help anything. Or there's things that they do that we don't talk about enough that may stay private or whatever. Like, you know, I think a lot of people have talked about Trotz building this, like, family. Like, I don't really know what that means completely, but because, you know, there's no details to that. But you can tell that this team, just by looking at Ovechkin in a lot of ways, where, you know, even when Trotz first came in, he was like, well, I just want him to put his stick on the ice for defense. And, you know, as soon as Ovechkin did that and kind of stopped twirling at the blue line and kind of, you know, the whole team kind of has really changed, because when they had Boudreau, it seemed like they were just so loosey-goosey, especially when in the games that mattered. And then you look at the team now, they're giving up the least amount of goals in the NHL. I mean, a lot of that is talent. A lot of that is just how much they're taking the puck down the ice, and they have puck movers on defense. But, you know, Trotz has clearly done an amazing job. But sometimes I don't know what it is. I just watch certain things, and I'm just like, oh! Like when they put Beagle out on the first line, or... I'm trying to think of other things that bother me, but like,
you know how I feel about that. Don't you go there. Don't go there.
Here's actually an example. Last night, Trotz called out the second line, the first and second. There was like, our top six got shelled. You know, they just got dominated. And then, we looked at the, we just looked at the possession stats, and the people who got shelled the worst, Andrew Gordon, it was Jay Beagle's fourth line. Like, Beagle was, like, he got outshot by 12, plus 12. His line had 4 shots, 4 when he was on the ice, and 16 against, which is just dreadful.
Now, who's he matched with, though?
I can't tell you because I can't pull it up right now, but...
that's another thing. These advanced stats have to look at, too, is who you're matched with. If he's checking center taking defensive zone faceoffs against the Crosby line, I mean, if Sidney's winning over 50% of his faceoffs, there's going to be a lot of point shots generated. There's going to be a lot of offensive zone time. And Beagle isn't the guy who's starting in the offensive zone a lot. So naturally, he's going to have a negative shot differential, in my opinion, in a game like
that.
True.
But the fun thing – so here's a few fun things that have been figured out by the Voltori or the math nerds in hockey, is that actually you're going to cringe when you hear this. Like, you're going to, like, want to, like, just – turn off the computer and just, like, throw your laptop out the window. But it has been kind of determined that face-offs don't matter.
Where? How much time we have? How can I refute this for long enough?
But that's one thing. Another thing that has kind of been introduced in the stat sphere, and again, I don't know how great I'm articulating this because I'm not Peter and I'm not Pat who do our statistical analysis, but one thing too is that context, in a sense, with who you're matched up with has started to matter less and less as people have like looked, you know, a lot of times, let's say, for instance, like Mike Weber was on a terrible Buffalo Sabres team, and he had like the worst. He was the defenseman the Caps acquired last year, and he had horrible numbers. So part of the reason why his numbers were horrible was the context of the Buffalo Sabres. They were one of the most dreadful teams in the league. They had horrible depth, et cetera, et cetera. But what the stat nerds have noticed is that faceoffs kind of even out, and on top of that is that a lot of guys get. I don't know how to express this greatly, but the context of who they play against has started to even out too. So I don't know.
Maybe that's a testament to the quality of player that's coming through the league now, where the league is deeper from top to bottom. The players on the fourth line are absolutely now becoming stronger.
I think you're right there.
But I mean, if you're looking at a guy like Ovechkin, this is why I think Pittsburgh is dangerous as often as they are, is because they rarely have Crosby and Malkin on the same line. And so that means if you're going into Montreal, the Shea Weber defensive pair, whoever your top D pair is, has to decide we're matching up with one of these two lines. So Crosby, let's say, is going to play against Shea Weber for 17 out of his 19 minutes that night. That means Malkin's not playing against Weber for 17 of his minutes. And I think that is an advantage. There could be any number of different line combinations or changes or inferior players who are playing against high-end players. So it really pays dividends, I think, on teams that have really strong offensive players on their second and third lines instead of just loading up a top line. Because in my opinion, like I say, if you're not getting the top pair defensively, if you're not getting the top defensive center on every shift against your top guys, your opportunity to score should statistically, as you guys like to say, be improved.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense to anybody?
Yeah, well, I think it does, and I think the point I was kind of like hinting at was that a lot of times trots will, like, for instance, Tom Wilson for the first part of the year was just doing nothing, and yet other people would be benched, other people would be criticized. There are specific players on the team that are just bulletproof, like. Orpik's been great this year, so I don't have anything negative to say about him. But logic would dictate that, you know, at 36 years old and now injury prone somewhat, it would make sense to, like, maybe bench Orpik and give him some nights off if you want to get Taylor Chorney in the lineup, who we had on as a guest, you know, a few months ago. But instead, he benches Nate Schmidt, and when you look at the stats, you know, Schmidt might be the youngest defenseman on the team. So, okay, so it makes sense from the perspective of he's the youngest guy, he has to earn his way, which is a great message to send too. But then you're putting a inferior line out of Orpik and Chorney instead of Schmidt and Chorney, or Schmidt, or, you know, dropping Orlov out. Like, there's a million things you can do. And I think that's the thing that sometimes frustrates me about Trotz is that, I guess his team method of having people respect themselves and having this, like, very tight-knit leadership group, sometimes it's the worst thing for the team, if you know what I mean. Like, he's not making decisions sometimes that are for the best for the Capitals. It's for something else that isn't quantifiable, and it's a really old way of thinking. And I think that's why, you know, Beagle, love the guy. I would, you know, obviously, you played with him. He's the greatest person in the world. I mean, he's done so many little things for fans this year. He scored a bunch of big goals. He's become so much more talented skill-wise. But if you call out, you know, the two lines that pretty much scored all the goals last night, but then don't criticize a guy like Beagle, who, you know, the fourth line was actually bad, like, that's where I think I get confused as to what you know, I just don't understand sometimes. And I think
he's seeing the game a lot differently than most people are too. So, I mean, the expectation is different for different players. And absolutely. It's not, I think that when you're talking about taking Schmidt out as opposed to an Orpik, there's a veteran presence. There's different lineup that match up better against opposing teams. If there's a team that has bigger bodies, you want bigger, stronger bodies. If there's a team that's playing a more fast, up-paced game, maybe you want a different. You want Chorney in there. He's more of a skater, puck mover. I don't know. So coaches make a lot of decisions behind the scenes that we don't know about. And so I think lineup changes are really difficult to justify as fans or as people on the outside looking in, because we don't know anything. what's going on within those walls. So I don't think that the mentality is old school to have a veteran guy in the lineup who's, like you said, has been playing well this year, to your comments from the past, better than he has in the past. So I don't know. I think that the lineup is something that the coach has the final say over, because he's seeing things in a big picture the way he wants them to go. Maybe Nate Schmidt's part of the lineup against certain teams, or maybe he's just keeping him ready as more of an extra guy. I don't know. But I think the lineup itself is really hard to break down, because we don't see what he sees as a coach.
Yeah, that's true. And from a purely analytical standpoint, you know, you can't look at anything purely analytical. I mean, you have to have that context emotionally, you know, et cetera. Is that maybe Nate sees himself more as a bit guy, whereas Orpik is an alpha. And how can Orpik be a leader if he's a big guy in the locker room if he's being benched? So I definitely get that aspect of it, but I think for me, a lot of times I focus really heavily on the analytical a lot of times, and it's just hard to understand. But then I don't want to criticize him either, because the team has been amazing, and I'm seeing strides in the system play. You know, I think this team, especially Mitch Korn, I don't think people really, you know, I think Barry gets a lot of the credit for a lot of things that maybe Mitch Korn does, even with the goaltending. Like, Braden Holtby is just like a robot from outer space. Like, he makes everything look easy. I don't know how much.
Unbelievable.
Like, I just watch him play, and I'm like, I just remember Ole Kolzik. And this is kind of the metaphor I have in my head. Is I watched Ole Kolzik win the Vezina Trophy in, what was it, like 99-2000. And when he won that Vezina Trophy, he was great because he was sliding all over the place. I mean, he was making dramatic saves. I mean, he was big. Everything was hitting him. But he was the movement there and the flopping and just – it was unbelievable. And Holtby was like that in the beginning of his career. Now he's just – again, he's just like so – like, everything he does is for a reason. He plays actually a little bit deeper in net. He's less aggressive. Unless the puck is at the blue line, then he's skating out and getting it. And then that person might die if they try to get the puck from him. But like, he's just, his movement is so fluid and so controlled. And he just makes these unbelievable saves that I've seen, these shots I've seen go in thousands of times. He just makes these saves look so easy. And Carey Price, there's a lot, goaltending over the last 5 years, just in the NHL, I feel like has taken this extraordinary jump. You know what I mean?
I think completely right. Like, these guys, Carey Price, Pekka, these guys who are big bodies, positional goalies, are really, have sort of changed the face of goaltending lately. There was a phase where the Roman Chechmanek and Dominic Hasek were like the goalies flopping around, entertaining, sexy goaltending, if you will. And
yeah, that's a great metaphor to make.
Yeah, and so they were rolling around and dropping their stick and grabbing pucks with their hands and stuff. And it was, that changed the game. But it's now it's gone sort of totally back the other way, where it's just big, positional, make it look easy. Like, you don't, like, Carey Price has just got ice in his veins. And I think that's the objective for goalie coaches now, is to try to get guys to move less, but just be there. Just be in the way already without having to sprawl around. You know, and that's, I think Holtby's really sort of adapting to that culture.
He gets beat by stuff that's fluky. I mean, he's just mechanical. It's just amazing. Like, even, he gave up 5 goals against the Penguins, and I could not tell. He said the first one that Malkin scored was bad. But none of them I looked at, I go, he should have that. You know what I mean? It's unbelievable. I have never seen goaltending like this.
If he sees it, he's going to stop. It's the bottom line. You always say that as a defender, like in your own zone. Like, just let him see it. You'll never, like, unless it's the perfect shot from the perfect place, you're not going to beat him with a straight shot from the top of the circle. So, like, he has to have traffic or a rebound or a pass that makes him move so far laterally that he, you know, you can't physically stretch that far. You have to beat him some miraculous way, because if he sees that puck, he's going to stop it. He's just too good.
You know, and I did want to ask you this, because I know this is something I've noticed over the last 2 years, from the Caps Pens playoff series last year to last night's game too. The contrast is pretty crazy. The Capitals kind of rely on big heavy shots from like Ovechkin, like, or skill plays to score. And the Penguins, even though they have Crosby and Malkin, who are two of the most talented players in the NHL, almost all of their goals for the Penguins, it seems like they're just like, they have these like little set plays in the middle of the ice where they'll like pass it to a guy, or like they'll chip it towards a guy and he'll redirect. Like, I feel like the Penguins scored the most redirects and like indirect goals in the entire NHL. Like, do you notice anything that they do that is like definitely intentional?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the, like, the set plays and things just come from the players. It's not, you know, a lot of guys, like the better players in the league, are setting up plays on the fly, saying, okay, like, I've been beating this centerman on my left side, so when I win this puck back to you, take two steps and look for this guy on the backside. They're breaking down on their coverage over here, blah, blah, blah. They'll notice things in the heat of the moment. So it's hard to say, like, really, if there's going to be a lot of set plays, especially through the neutral zone where so much happens so fast. But, I mean, for the most part, that's a team that played together last year, stuck together from last year, and they had success, and that breeds more success. Guys like Connor Sheary are having enormous seasons as opposed to being call-up guys who are just finding their stride. So I think confidence is probably high from a Stanley Cup champion team coming back. And I mean, it's hard, like I say, it's really hard to put your finger on if they're doing a lot of set plays, but maybe something they work on in practice. I know certain teams that I've played for in other leagues and stuff have worked on things like instead of passing the point and having the defenseman just try to shoot as hard as he can on net, aiming 5 feet off and having guys off to the side. You see Sidney's off to the side of the net. Most of the time he's never standing in front screening directly in front of the goalie. He's always sort of shading off to 5-7 feet off the post. And that's where he gets a lot of those tip-ins from. And it might be something that they've talked about and worked on in the past as well. So defensemen knowing, put their head down and hammer the puck 7 feet wide and know that it's not going to get blocked because it's not heading on net and there's going to be a guy there. So it could be just a different offensive mentality altogether.
It almost seems like their offensive mentality is chaos in front. And I agree. I've noticed Sidney, while like on even strength, he will screen, but like on power plays, exactly, he's just hanging around the net. Like, I always try to understand his greatness. And I mean, obviously he does everything well. I mean, incredible passer, incredible skater, so strong in the legs. Like, he reminds me a lot of Jágr for how strong he is on the puck. But I think the thing is with him is just, he's just, he went to the next level somehow, like 5 years ago. I remember he just started like dedicating himself to going to the net hard. And I think Ovechkin has done a little bit of the same thing too. And I think he probably looked at Crosby and was like, I need to do this. But, you know, they just scored goals so easily last night. And sometimes the goals they score, it's always like it's chaos in front of the net. Like Holtby can stop a shot, but Holtby can't stop chaos a lot of times, because that's when you slide out of position, you know. And I think that's why they're so lethal. And you're right. It's just they've all been playing together so well. A lot of the young guys that they brought in are just fit seamlessly. But yeah, just watching that game last night, the contrast was kind of clear. And I think that's probably why a lot of times they've won the bigger games in the playoffs too, is that it's a lot easier to predict a goal from chaos in front of the net as it is from a one-time slap shot on the power play or a skill play. Like, it's just more predictable that you can score in front of the net and it's just chaos and someone pots a rebound or, you know, everybody kind of has a sixth sense of where to pass to next or chip the puck. And
there's a term I like to use. I call it manufacturing offense. And I think it's relatively popular in sports. But there's a difference between, like, just being a skilled guy making a skill play and the kind of goals that you need to score in the playoffs, where you're dumping the puck in and you're running into two guys and you cycle it twice and you throw a bad angle shot to the net and then the next guy scoops in and falls over and it goes off his foot to someone else and then it goes in. Like, you just grind your way to make that chaos happen. And it's not easy to get the puck to the net in the NHL. These guys are so big and so strong and so good positionally. But to be able to manufacture offense to create chaos and create those second, third chance opportunities out of nothing is a different skill altogether. I mean, you can have all the skill in the world and sit on the outside and throw beautiful passes around, but if that tic-tac-toe doesn't work, you're back-checking 5 seconds later. The manufacturing of offense, the grimy goals, are the ones I think that down the stretch in the playoffs, and like you say, these important games can sometimes be the difference maker, and not every team has the guts in them to do it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And like I said, I think the reason why the Caps had so much success in this last streak was just because their system hockey was so simplified. And maybe Trotz has been just telling them this and hammering this for the last 3 years, but you're really seeing results now. But God, like, when this team just goes hard to the net, they don't curl on the, as soon as they go into the zone, you know, like, I don't even think they're necessarily great forecheckers like this team. Like, I think they're just great when they use their speed, go in straight lines, use their skill from that. And almost all the goals they scored was like breakdowns. Like, it was like, they were like even strength rushes or odd man breaks, and just, you know, they were just going in straight lines, peeling around players. And then once you have that speed and that open ice, this team is almost unstoppable.
I thought Backstrom's goal was a video clip you could use to demonstrate like the perfect forecheck.
Oh, which one was that? I don't even remember.
Puck went in the corner. I think it was Ovi went in, put a guy through the
end.
Oh,
the double check by Ovechkin.
And then, he chips it in, goes and runs somebody through the boards. Oshie comes around the left side, and he sort of stays wide on the boards. He comes around behind the net once his contact was made. He wants to be the second guy in. Ovi squirts that loose puck into open ice just behind the defenseman's feet. Oshie knows exactly where that third man is because that's the pattern he's running on the forecheck. He can throw a blind pass out there and know exactly where Backstrom's coming down the dot lane. Pucks off the pipe and in.
I feel like that's the exception to the rule for the first line. But no, I know. I think that's exactly right. That is literally the perfect forecheck. I think I've seen like it from the third line lately too, like with Brett Connolly and Burakovsky and Lars Eller. I mean, ooh. You know, and like you even see it more with the second line with Kuznetsov doing his fancy twister pass to Justin Williams, and they score infinite goals.
Yeah.
but I don't know, but like everything they're doing system wise seems to be legit. Like, I've never noticed the system as much as I have right now, I guess. So I feel like that's a good thing.
I think a challenge with a team like that is like you mentioned earlier, how much ability they have. And it's I think that's part of a challenge for Trotz, for Barry, is to take a team with that much ability and make them play a grind style of game. Make a skill guy want to grind is difficult. You know, you can't make a zebra change his stripes kind of thing, but it's like if you can just put that work ethic, that Jay Beagle mentality into a guy like Nick Backstrom, then he's outworking you and outskilling you. And I think that's the kind of drive that team needs to really get over that cusp and find themselves in the finals again, find themselves as a champion. It's because I think Pittsburgh last year did that. They found a way to take the bodies they had, which was a skilled team, but they were just grinding, and they won so many games in overtime in the playoffs, and they won so many one-goal games and came from behind. And so I think this team is so skilled that it's almost difficult to manufacture those goals because their skills are too good. It's a wonderful problem to have, I guess.
No, it's true. You know, and that actually kind of runs me to another question. I've gotten this a few times from readers is, Ian, what do you think the Caps need down the stretch for the trade deadline? And I don't know. Like last year when the Caps and Pens played, it was so even, you know, a lot of times I hear, everybody's favorite sideline announcer Pierre Maguire talk about how, like, you know, he's Mr. Narrative. You know, like Ovechkin, he wasn't, you know, I've never seen Ovechkin have as much fun as he has lately. And I'm just like, have you been watching hockey for the last, like, he hasn't changed it. Like, there was times where, you know, he was depressed. Like, let's say you could tell that something was off after him and Maria split up, you know, Maria Kirilenko, his former fiance. You could tell in the Dale Hunter time and towards the end of the Bruce time, there was frustration. You could tell at times he's maybe not loved the spotlight at times. Like, he's rather, but like I've never really seen him not have fun playing hockey. Like, so when I heard him say that, I was just like, Pierre, what are you talking about? But it's just like last year, too. It's like, oh, you know, we didn't own the big moments and this and that. And then you look at the analytics, and really, it was just luck. Like, the Caps and Penguins were literally equal. And it was a save here, it was a save there, it was a bounce here, it was a bounce there. There wasn't anything they could have done better, you know? And so I feel like it's going to be the same thing this year, is that this team is about as good as you can possibly get in the NHL. They could probably have another top four defenseman. I think Carl Alsner has really struggled this year. But, like, I don't know how much, you know, if you have any opinions on what the team would need. But I don't think they need any of those bit guys. Those you know, they, last year they got Mike Weber. In the past they've got, what was it, a Glenn Cross, or I forget his, Curtis Glenn Cross. They've gotten these guys that have kind of just, you know, not done it. They've been third or fourth liners. They've barely played. If they get somebody, they need an impact guy. But I actually think that a lot of the, you know, Jacob Verana, I honestly think that if he's optimized and he's playing his best hockey, I think he's better than any person they could trade for forward-wise. And then looking at defense, you know, you would have to give up an exorbitant price to get a top four guy. Is that worth it with the top six that you have right now? And I don't know.
And also, if you're playing with a team down the stretch who's sneaking into the eighth spot, trying to make a push for the playoffs, I think those are the teams that need to pick up maybe a top four defenseman to help put them over the edge to get them into contention. But if you're winning the East, you know, I don't think you really have the same issues that some of these other teams have. So the deadline shouldn't be quite as big of a deal for you. You know, the classic line every year at the playoff at the deadline is sometimes the best trades are the ones you don't make. And you don't want to shuffle things up too badly if you have a winning roster who's doing damage to the whole league for 8 months already. I mean, if you can get a guy, I think picking up a guy like Weber last year as a depth guy was a smart decision, because if you go deep in the playoffs, you know, you need strong, reliable players. But, I mean, do they make a trade and trade a current roster player to try to upgrade in that position? I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, in my opinion. Stick with the roster that's sort of been winning all season long. And I'm a believer in that family concept that they're trying to put together there, where the guys want to go to battle with each other. They want this group to succeed, and they've had fun, and they've built something together over the course of the year, and it can almost dislodge that chemistry by taking guys out and trying to influx new players into a position just to force the issue.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, for me, it's even how good can this team be without needing to be skilled? Like, I would almost use the entire regular season as like, grinding practice. Like, How much easier can you score without it being hard? Because that's the thing I've noticed, is that, you know, in the playoffs, you come into these games and, you know, a lot of times you need a big goal, and you're not going to get that skill play. You're never going to get that skill play in the playoffs. And it's usually, what kind of chaos can I create? Like, I really think they just need to continue to build their repertoire as a team. A lot of people have been telling me, Gordo, you know, are the Caps peaking too early? Is that a thing in hockey?
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing. The league is so strong, and virtually all these pro leagues are, and I can say the same thing about our league here. But it's not necessarily about who's the best team in the league on paper. It's who's playing the best at the right time. And that's how LA snuck into the eighth hole in the West, I think, twice, and won the cup both times. Like, who's playing the best at the right time of the year? And I mean, do I think Columbus is going to win the Stanley Cup? Probably not. I don't think many teams win 16 in a row in the regular season and follow that up with a Stanley Cup championship. So it's hard. It's hard to play the right way, because everyone's going out and trying as best they can every night. So the stars don't always align at the right time of year, but I mean, if peaking too early is the issue, you don't really know until it's all said and done. Maybe Caps won 9 in a row, but that might not be the peak. You know, they might not be playing as well as they can. They might have just been winning.
Here's what I want you to break down for me, is that what does peaking too early mean to you as a hockey player? Now, peaking could mean, like, you know, obviously winning a bunch of games, but what is the mentality? Like, what is happening when you're in that? Because you were with a Hershey Bears team that almost basically went undefeated. And what was it, 2010, where you guys just, like, ran through everyone? But what... how do the Caps prevent that? Because, like, in February, they have that bye week now that the NHL is mandated. Like, how do you achieve that? Like, is it, like, I feel like it's something random that just naturally happens.
Well, I think it's every season is a process, and it's, I mean, that's how, if you look at teams that start a season poorly, you can improve and still be a contender by the end. Just because you lose the first handful of games of the year doesn't mean you'll lose the last handful. So I think if you're constantly process based, and if you're constantly challenging yourself against yesterday's self, then that's the objective, is to get better every day and to be a better team tomorrow than you were today. And so that being said, no matter if you've won 9 in a row or if you've lost 9 in a row, that next day is an opportunity to improve. And whether you're breaking down video and saying, okay, little tiny things, like we can back check further through the middle, or we can react quicker in this regard, there's things you can tweak no matter how many games in a row you've won. And if you've gone, you know, 40 games in a row without a single loss, you can still get better. And as long as you're pushing yourself and don't get complacent, that's achievable. So, I mean, that year that we played in Hershey, we won 61 games or something outrageous. I mean, our practices were harder than our games because we were, you know, if you're scrimmaging against your second, third, fourth lines, they were better than any other team's first, second, third, or fourth lines. So realistically, like, we were beating each other up in practice and taking the weekends off, going 3-0, and everyone had 5 points, and we were good.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, that's how I felt about it. Like, you worked harder and pushed each other harder in practice than you did going into Binghamton on a Saturday. But that's the way it's sort of got to be approached, I think, is that the season is long, and that you can't just rest on the work you've done to achieve 9 in a row, because that wins you nothing. It's about pushing yourself and the team and the guy beside you to be better the next day and the next day and the next day, because at the end of the season, there's a limited amount of days, and if you're still getting better by the end, then that's when you should be playing your best hockey and your most structured, systematic hockey and your most confident hockey is right at the end of the year. And that's all theory. That rarely ever works. That probably works out for one, maybe two teams a year. But, I mean, that's the nature of the beast, is that not everyone can win and not everyone has that same ebbs and flows of a season. But that's the objective, is to be process-based, understand the difference between the first day of September and the last day of, you know, May, June, when that cup's handed out.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, the Capitals, it always seems like, you know, we constantly hear the peaking too early thing, and I hope this year, and it seems like the team is built a lot better, that maybe, you know, on top of, you know, making the right moves down the stretch, you know, there's a gearing up towards the end. And I'm really going to be interested to see how much that bye week messes with everybody. I know that, like, Toronto just had theirs, and I wonder if having it early instead of in February, if that's something that's helpful for other teams. But now I know that you need to go to bed pretty soon because we're going into the morning in our dear Sweden. I would love to answer a few questions. I ask people for questions on our Twitter, at Russian Certainly. Machine. There's a few funny ones.
So, here we go.
Mike the Yeti asks a very good question. Russian Machine, why does it seem like refs disappear late in games versus the Penguins? I'll let you take this one, Gordo, as I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like this is a type of disgruntled fan comment that could go up between any team. It's not, if you hate the Rangers, I bet the whistle would go away against the Rangers too. And if you got beat the night before to Colorado, which nobody does anymore, I'm sure you would end up being mad at Colorado. So I don't know. I think the officials are trying to do the best job they can. I've never blamed officials really for much in my career. I've told them they've made poor decisions, but I don't. Games never hinge on a call. It's a 60-minute game, and if you put yourself in a position to have that one call hinge the game, then you made some mistakes already.
And, you know what, honestly, I think that while I feel Mike the Yeti's sentiment 100%, is that, honestly, there were some things that happened last night that if it didn't happen the way it happened, the Capitals would have won easily. But I will say that I think that the whole thing with the Penguins get preferential treatment is something that is initiated by their commentating crew, Pierre McGuire, Mike Milbury. A lot of, you know, over the last 10 years, we have watched national games. You know, Milbury has called Ovechkin Euro trash. You know, for all that, you know, there's some good things that Pierre does, but one thing is that there is something out there where it's like Pierre favors Crosby, that Crosby is his favorite player, that he gets no more excited about any other player than Crosby. And the thing is that I think the reporting of NBC and a lot of the national broadcasts are so poor sometimes that a lot of people put this onto the NHL and the referees. You know what I mean? Where they kind of project NBC's bias on the refs. And then, you know, we all wear tinfoil hats and get really, really mad. I think that's the thing that I've noticed over the last 10 years. It's just that if there was better national coverage, you know, like I've never watched a Hockey Night in Canada game and gone, oh my God, they favor the Leafs. You know what I mean? If anything, they're the hardest on the Leafs as anybody, as any other team in the NHL. And so, you know, I think that's something that all of us have to kind of make sure that we don't conflate poor coverage and bias by certain people onto officials who I do think are trying your best, like you said before. Like, I really think that's the honest problem with Caps fans.
Well, you gotta, maybe you guys should sick your statistics guys on this and see how many penalties the Penguins have drawn or have committed in the third period versus other teams and see if it actually correlates to a difference.
I think that was a post Neil did like 4 or 5 years ago, and it ended up being like the Capitals got more power plays. So it's all mental. Like, you know, again, I think the other part of it is too is that past context is all the Penguins always win the big games. And it should, you know, when you're always playing a team like over a stretch of 40 years, it should be pretty even. But then when you see the Penguins, they've won 9 of 11. To me, in my analytical brain, that means that the Caps are due and it's bound to swing back the Capitals' way at some point. But I think just all the context, it makes everyone very critical and a little tinfoil hatty about some of the decisions that happened during game. And I get, I'm the same way. So, Mike the Yeti, I'm with you. I feel you. I think both of us have to grow emotionally and philosophically to get past this. But I think also, NBC is part of this too, is that when some of their guys give bad analysis, they're not, you know, they don't find better people, you know, they just keep on giving us, you know, Milbury. And while Jeremy Roenick does great interviews, I think that sometimes his analysis is very poor. And I don't, and you know, he shouldn't be giving, like, you know, great analysis, you know, that should be left for other people who maybe can look deeper. But so that's one thing. Angry Chicken Farm asks, why is 42 the answer to everything? I don't really know what she means, unless she means Joel Ward, and he is the answer to everything, so I agree.
Joel Ward,
I mean, the big cheese fixes everything. So, I mean, not only is cheese delicious, Joel Ward is a great hockey player. let's see. At Jimmy Wrights asks, if Jay Beagle hits 12 plus goals, 20 plus assists, and keeps up his solid PK work, does he become a legit Selke candidate? I know what Gordo's going to answer, and the answer is
yes.
And my response is if Nicholas Backstrom can't even get as a finalist, Jay Beagle has no chance. But go ahead, elaborate.
I think Beagle should win the MVP. Oh, God. Is he nominated for that yet?
No, I'm slamming my no. Gordo, he is a great guy, a great player, but no, we're too in love. Like I said with Mike the Yeti, you need to.
I need to grow emotionally.
You need to grow emotionally here.
Get over my love affair with Jay. but no, I don't think the problem. The Selke, it's funny trophy actually because it's for the best defensive player, but it's also handed out to usually some of the most offensive players in the league. Guys like Datsyuk win it. You know, like, some of the most high-end skill players on the planet win the Defensive Player of the Year award. I think it's sort of a backwards trophy, but, a guy like Beagle, is he one of the better defensive players in the league, better sort of turning into one of the better third, fourth line, two-way guys in the league? Yes, absolutely. But, I mean, I don't think he's ever really going to be in contention to win an NHL award, unfortunately.
You know what? There should be a Grinder award, though. And it should be like, I can't think of a dog food company, but like a dog food company should sponsor it. It's like, you know, the scrappy award of the year. I can't even think of it. The Ty Domi award. You know, they need to give the Grinder some love, you know?
Yeah, we call them plumbers too. You'd be like a golden plunger or something.
Plumber, Grinder of the year.
Plumber of the year.
No, I actually think that would be fun. I think, you know, not to go on a huge rant, but like I think the NHL could embrace more of the fun aspect of, you know, sometimes it's like they're wearing leather pants and are very uptight. Like, you know, people love the sport for, you know, the grind. Like, you know, like people love Stephen Pete. People loved Chris Simon. That's Peter Hassett's favorite player. So, you know, there's, you know, I love Beagles. But no, and okay, so we have another question about Beagle from one of my favorite people on the internet, at Holtby Fan Club. She asks, is the recent rise in Beagle hype justified?
Well, I mean, if he's on pace for, you know, 12 to 15 goals and 20, if you're a guy's on the third or fourth line and you're going to pick up anywhere in the ballpark of 30 points, you are so valuable. It's insane. Guys are getting 50 points, are making $5.5 million. And playing in all-star games.
So if your fourth line
center is getting 30, you are wildly valuable.
Tom Wilson is making $2 million, and I questioned if he was even going to make the double-digit mark. But then he had a random three-point game, and now he's projected to do so. Yeah. But, yeah, I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. The big signing was probably not necessary, but of anyone who deserves it, it's him. You know what I mean?
I'm glad he's right now. If you got a guy making $1 million who's getting 30 points for you, that's very rare. And so I think that the value they're getting for that player is justified, and the hype is justified because he's scoring. If he was just blocking shots and killing penalties for $1 million, I think he'd still be worth it because guys do that for more than that. Like the guy Cal Clutterbuck has just got signed for an outrageous sum of money, and Beagle I would take 10 times over him.
Oh my God, yeah. You know what? We can agree on that one. Clutterbuck.
So I think the justifiable uprising, more Beagle, more Beagle, more Beagle, is perfectly normal given the fact that he's putting up numbers. He's not costing the team a huge cap hit, and like you said, he's doing great things for the fans on a day-to-day basis, so I think people should appreciate everything they get with that guy.
And like you know, a roster full of Jay Beagles would beat the Gretzky Oilers.
In my opinion, yes.
Okay, so...
A dynasty to be messed with.
A dynasty. A Beagle dynasty. Okay. So Justin asks, what will it take to bring in another top four defender? Should we just trade Holtby for Mike Green? Fun bunch! And that's a reference to the... you know, obviously a very offensive team or like the Redskins who just constantly scored by outscoring teams. No, I don't think we should ever trade Braden Holtby. But I just don't think there's really not much to do with this team. They're really good.
It would take a lot of cap space. A top four defenseman is going to be another $4 or $5 million player.
You don't have that.
I mean,
yeah,
you don't have that cap space. You're going to have to give up someone who's making that much. And I mean, it's if someone on the team is making that much on a first place team, they're probably doing a good job. So you're trading a good player, hoping that the new one somehow contributes more. I think, again, like I say with this team, if you develop a team the way that they have been and the way that they're continuing to grow, they shouldn't need to pick up another top four defenseman. I think they've been grooming top four defensemen since I was in the organization, for God's sake.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, God, I just got 20 tweets about something I need to cover. Hilariously enough. So we have a few more good questions here. We got like 30 after I hit refresh. What is goalie interference? Dave Stevenson asks, a fan-sided Dave.
When you pretty much don't allow the goalie to move the way he wants to move.
Gordo, you're saying last night the Penguins committed goalie interference.
Most likely. Let me tell you, in Sweden, if you, like, sneeze on the goalie, they call you and you get penalties for it. But I think in the NHL, it's pretty much like a, if you are not allowing the goalie to come out and challenge, if you're not allowed, if the puck's going laterally and you don't let him move laterally, they got to call it. If you hit him with your stick, something that'll distract him, there's a lot of different situations, but I think that the biggest sticking point that I've been told is if you are limiting the goaltender's movement and his ability to make the save, you are interfering with the goaltender. It's the same as a player. If you're interfering with his ability to get to the puck, then you are interfering.
Yeah, I think the NHL still needs to grow a little bit about, there's a lot of, it's not, amazingly, it's not as simple as that. It like even last night, is that Daniel Winnick had his glove out. Did he trip the guy? That's arguable. Did he trip Hornquist, or did Hornquist kind of hit his glove and fall over? Like, did Winnick do enough to impact Hornquist, who then went into the goalie, and then the Penguins scored? Like, that nuance is so narrow that it's extremely hard to define. Like, I think you have to define, on top of what you just said, is what is a guy impacting another guy for goalie interference? And that's really hard. They were looking at this goal for like 10 minutes and it got quiet in the Penguins arena, and we all kind of assumed they'd wave it off. So I think that's another thing they need to grow on. Another question from Michael Rashley. He asked, this is very funny, Gallant, Boudreau, Oates, Capuano, is Jason Chimera a coach killer?
Interesting concept. I didn't put those pieces together, actually, but I would say no, because he's, at least for the brief stint that I ever met that guy, he was the coolest guy of all time, maybe.
But isn't he practically you can't understand what he's saying because he talks so fast.
Because he's so happy about whatever he's saying.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, he's too busy smiling and like laughing halfway through his comments. He was a great dude, so I would really hope that he's not the problem.
That was a great question, though. Oh, God. Let's see. So many questions about the trade deadline. We kind of covered that. Why are the PennHL and the PennNBC so biased for Pittsburgh? I don't know. Pierre, no one understands Pierre.
People like winners.
Yeah, I guess. Let's see. And then I got all these tweets about something I have to cover. All right. So anyways, I guess the last piece of news to cover really quickly is that RMNB will be hosting our 10th party, RMNBX, which behind the scenes, me and Peter were worried about calling it X because, you could obviously add two more X's to that and it'd be kind of weird. We'll be having that at the Iron Horse at 12 o'clock. I should actually look what the date is because I don't remember it off the top of my head. February 4th at the Iron Horse. It'll be at noon. We'll be having a special poster we made, and I'll just say it's dedicated to everyone's most happiest defenseman. We'll have some shirts that you guys always want, and we'd love to see you. I'll hug you. Peter will run away from you because he loves being to himself, but we're having that in a few weeks, so we can't wait to see you guys. And Gordo, if you weren't in the middle of a season in Sweden, I'd love to see you.
Maybe next year.
We'll try to schedule something in the summer and have you make that 20-hour drive down.
I'd do it. I would do it for you guys. For you guys, anything.
So I guess we'll end it here. But Gordo, it was so nice to talk to you. How is the big number 13 doing in Linköping? I can't say it. How have you done lately? I need to know your stat totals and judge you on that.
Well, they haven't been overly impressive lately, but the team's been winning, which is a big thing. So we are one of these teams that started out solely, but we're sort of the hottest group in the league right now. We won 5 in a row and have a few more winnable games coming up, so we're doing well. goals are at a premium right now. I think we've scored in these games. We've won 5 in a row. I think we've scored something like 9 goals in 5 games. It's crazy how low scoring the league is right now. But it's turned really defensive. Really defensive. So.
Is that because all you Canadians have come to the league and just want to grind it out?
I wish that was the case. I'm the only Canadian on the team right now, and I think there's only a handful of us in the league, so I guess we're not to blame. Maybe these Swedes are just practice skating backwards so much or trapping all the time now. I don't know.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
A lot of Swedes trapping these days. Don't like it.
I thought the Swedes loved open ice and having no emotion and
riding bikes.
Well, that's awesome. Well, it was great to talk to you. Continued success. I hope by the time I talk to you next, you guys have railed off 10 in a row, unlike the Capitals could do. And I hope you have a great week. And yeah, it was so great to catch up with you, man.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm glad we got back on the air. And to all the listeners, wonderful to see you again. Talk to you guys all soon.
All right, later, man.
Been Russian Machine Never Breaks, the podcast. But now it's over. Nothing to see here. Move along.